Hello and welcome to season one of the International Podcast. I'm Obin Nachukwu. I currently teach and research politics at the University of York. Over the course of the next couple of episodes, we'll be looking at the critical and pivotal events and issues that are very important to understanding the current makeup of the current global order. We focus particularly on the African continent and look at those key things and processes that have created the world we live in today. Enjoy. In this episode, we speak with Professor Toby Green, who's Professor of African History at King's College London. We speak with Professor Hassim Cisse, who's Director General of the National Centre for Arts and Culture in The Gambia. And we speak with Dr. Stephen Pierce, who teaches African history at the University of Manchester. So in this episode, we're speaking on the importance of states and internal and external threats that they sought to balance tax collection, the introduction of vast standing armies, and the possession and importance of firearms. So now we speak with Professor Toby Green, who is Professor of African History at King's College London.
And what were the most important empires at the beginning of the 15th century?
Well, okay, so in the 15th century, you had the Empire of Mali, which was still very important and was kind of almost at its height in the beginning of the 15th century. And that stretched from the Atlantic coast in Senegambia to Mali and influencing areas of what are now Niger and northern Nigeria. And then you also had Kano. Kano was becoming more and more important in the 15th century in northern Nigeria. Nupe to the south between Kano and the Atlantic coast from the Niger Delta. Further west, you had a rise of a lot of different states in the 15th century. The 15th century was a time of change. You had Mossi arising in Burkina Faso, and later in the 15th century you had Songhai kind of dethroning Mali as more important in the Sahel, which was located further to the east between centered in what's now Gao.
On the west coast, how about the Benin and the Oyo?
I get confused when you talk about the west coast. I'm thinking of
the America west coast.
Oyo didn't really rise to be powerful until the 16th century. Benin, yes, Benin was becoming more powerful, particularly in the middle of the 15th century. Benin's the real rise to, well, at the time, in the beginning of the 15th century, Nupe was more important than Benin, but then Benin became more important through the 15th century.
How about in the north? I mean, what were the major states in the north around this period?
So Songhai fell to the Moroccan army, yes, in 1591. And I think, you know, stepping back, you know, and that was very important because you had these, you'd had three major kind of imperial systems in Western West Africa. So from the coast around Senegal into the Niger River, you'd had, first of all, the Empire of Ghana, which was more located in what's now Mauritania, then Mali, and then Songhai. Songhai falls in 1591, and it's kind of a decline of this big imperial system. But it's also the beginning of the rise of more modern forms of statehood in West Africa, which, as you say, are based around kind of the development of taxation systems, the development of standing armies, development of complex administrations. All of those things tend to start happening really beginning in the 17th century. So Oyo, which you mentioned, Asante, which will come later in the 18th century in Ghana, Dahomey, which will start in the 18th century in Benin. And of course, when we say, and actually it's very important to say, you know, the things which really help those states to form, which were, yes, ability to tax, better currency flows, military control, monopoly of violence, and military projection beyond the state's borders. Actually, if we stand back and look at the systems of state building in Europe at the same time, they're actually very similar. And in fact, one of the things I've argued is that, you know, this idea that has emerged in European historiography and international relations historiography of a fiscal military state in the 17th and 18th century is actually very much what was happening as well in those the more powerful states in West Africa at the same time.
Yeah. In Asia as well, you know, in many parts of Asia as well, and in the Pacific.
This is a facet of state building in the early one.
Exactly. How about down south? I mean, you had a few kingdoms, but you had the powerful states in the Kingdom of Congo, which developed much later. But what states were prevalent in the earliest period down south? This is before Shaka Zulu and the Mfikani. The Congo, were they prevalent around the 15th century?
Yeah, so Congo became, John Thornton, who's done the most detailed research on the early history of Congo, I would say, suggested that Congo as a state forms around the end of the 14th century or the beginning of the 15th century. So again, it predates European arrival at the end of the 15th century. And by the time that the Portuguese arrived in the 1480s, Congo had a capital city with quite a large population, 30,000, 40,000 perhaps. But it also had a federated kingdom, essentially, with viceroys, if you like, in each of the different provinces.
So now we hear a recording of Zainab Badawi speaking with Professor Olutunde Oduobi on the rise of the Kanem-Bornu Empire.
The Kingdom of Kanem, which was established in the 9th century, lasting until the 14th century. At its height, it covered much of the Chad Basin and modern-day northeastern Nigeria, parts of southern Libya, eastern Niger, and northern Cameroon.
The king has several ties, and that's to tell you how successful the state was in terms of trade. Horses were very expensive, mind you, and so it tells you the extent, you know, of the huge the nature of the trade between Kanem and North Africa.
By the late 14th century, the Bornu Empire, sometimes referred to as the Kanem-Bornu Empire, had emerged. And the best-known king, or Mai, is Idris Eluma, who reigned for more than 30 years. He was an accomplished military man, skilled administrator, and gifted diplomat. And under his rule, the Bornu Empire flourished.
Funny enough, most of what we know of Idris Eluma was just about 12 years of his reign, because some of these things were actually documented. We don't know what happened thereafter. So for 12 years, it became so magnified. No doubt it was a glorious reign. And again, for Idris Eluma too, with him came the period of firearms, one of the reasons why he was successful.
So now we speak with Professor Hassum Cisse, who is Director General of the National Center for Arts and Culture in the Gambia.
On majority of states in Africa. So when did firearms really start to proliferate across the continent? I was around the 15th, 16th, or 14th century?
Well, I would say from the 15th century, really, with the arrival of the Europeans, the Portuguese explorers, the Spaniards, the British, the French, in that order, because literally all the exploration ships had to be fortified, it had to be garrisoned, because they were going into terra incognita, unknown territory, with all these stories of wild tribes, hostile tribes in Africa.
Yes.
So really, I mean, you had sailors and you had guns, on board those ships. From the 1450s onwards. So I think that could have been the first introduction, really, of firearms into, Africa, in West Africa in particular. Mm-hmm. And then, as time went on, this proliferation of firearms started, they used them, the kings and the emperors saw how effective they were and would ask if they could have one or two firearms, in exchange for maybe a slave or two, So really, by the 1700, all the strong African states like Dahomey, the Yoruba states, Jollof, Gambia, really had, cavalry, horse and spears and bow and arrows, but also, a contingent, bearing, loaded, firearms, with gunpowder and caps. I know this because in the Gambia archives, at about this time, in the 1820s, really gunpowder was the most, imported commodity. Sometimes in some months, and there was so much gunpowder being imported into the country that we wonder whether the entire British settlement was at war. And this gunpowder, of course, found its way into what is called today Senegal, today called Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, yes. with yes. different African rulers. I'm buying the gunpowder for their armies. Yes.
Okay, so let's start from around that period. So around the 15th, 16th century, we started to see the coalition of states across the continent since settlements and strong kingdoms were very prosperous. So what was the most important thing for them? Balancing internal threats, external threats, tax collection, or the introduction of standing armies? Because prior to the beginning, when you started having standing armies, armies were there to basically protect the king. But when they start increasing into more and more states and expanding into empires, you know, armies became extremely important. So what would you say was the most important reason for the state around this period, 15th, 16th century, across the continent?
Well, I think there were economic reasons and also reasons of, you know, of survival. I mean, this was a period, you know, when your survival really depended on how much men you could put on the field, you know, to defend or to offend. The whole issue of getting a standing army and equipping it with, you know, firearms, horses, you know, was like a survival tactic. You know, it was like a survival strategy. You know, the stronger your army, the better the chances that you will keep the borders of your state or your kingdom intact. Now, also, some of these Europeans had to be really forced at gunpoint to pay tax to the African rulers. So that was also one
exactly.
of the army. A good example is the Bara state in present-day Gambia. The king of Bara, several of the kings of Bara had to, do like a naval blockade, to blockade the entry to the mouth of the River Gambia so that the French traders, the British traders, you know, and other European traders, even the Americans, you know, who wanted to sail into the River Gambia to trade, paid their taxes before, they proceeded, you know, down the river. You know, so you had all these, you know, incidents, you know, like standoffs, you know, between the Bara King and his, you know, naval forces and, you know, a British, you know, trading ship, wanted to sneak into the River Gambia to trade without paying taxes. But it even escalated into a full war in 1830, you know, what is called the British Bara War. You know, Bara is Barra, and, you know, like in the present day Republic of the Gambia. And this war was basically as a result of the refusal of the British to pay taxes to the monarch of Bara, even though, they traded in Bara territory. Yes. So having a standing army well equipped also ensured that you are able to collect money for the kitty of your state, of your empire.
Okay. That's fantastic. And so the next thing is, we know that many states were powerful around this period. Did they know about each other? I mean, we know they did. Did they know about each other? Did they exchange ambassadors? And when they did, was there immunity? And I know majority of the reasons why they exchanged ambassadors just for trade. So what did they trade? Ironworks, cloth, weapons, horses, and also did they trade art?
I think I understand your question.
Yes,
diplomacy was basically economic diplomacy. There was a lot of economic diplomacy. And there was also what I can, call broad diplomacy, I'll explain both. the states, for example, the Kingdom of Bara and the Kingdom of Kongo, they just had the island of Batros in separating them. So they really depended on each other. And Bara produced a lot of rice, for example. It also had like a lot of, you know, forest products like timber. Okay. At the same time, in Kongo, you know, it had a very, very important fishing ground, you know, fish, you know, dry fish, you know, fresh fish. And also, I mean, horticulture. You know, European explorers, you know, were surprised at the amount of, I mean, fruit trees, you know, growing, you know, in the Kongo. So that offered a way of, you know, like economic, I mean, interdependence. You know, I mean, that's diplomacy that I'm referring to.
Yes.
Such that, there was every effort to make sure that between Bara and Kongo, you know, these two states, you know, there was like a diplomatic, you know, ties, you know, were maintained so as to promote, you know, the economic interests of both the states. And now by the broad in diplomacy, I meant some of these kings of various states, they intermarried. Yes. You know, like the king of Bara, for example, can give his daughter to the king of Kongo. Like the king of Kongo can give his daughter to the king of Jolof. I mean, in present day Senegal, you know, the world of state.
Yes.
You know, of Jolof. So that also ensured, a form of, you know, diplomatic presence, you know, diplomatic recognition. I mean, among these, you know, states. So really, you know, maybe not, in the, a modern sense of, you know, diplomacy with, you know, ambassadors, you know, presenting their credentials and so on. Mm-hmm. But diplomacy in the sense of putting in place, mechanisms which ensured peaceful coexistence, you know, marriage, you know, blood ties, you know, and other social, you know, kinships.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Also, so how important was salt around this period? I know it was a very important commodity because...
Salt was the spice.
Because there was no other method of preserving food unless you dried it. So I know in certain areas, salt was traded wheat for wheat with gold. And the Trans-Saharan trade, for example, was dominated by the salt trade. People going back with camels all the way down to Mediterranean and selling into Europe. So how important was that commodity and other commodities around this period?
Yeah, I mean, salt was a very, very important commodity, like the white gold, you know, of this part of, you know, West Africa. You know, you had the maritime, you know, aspect. You know, so, I mean, in the river, you know, Senegal, for example, in the river Saloum, along the river Gambia, and you have settlements, you know, whose main preoccupation was to manufacture salt, you know, to process salt. I mean, from the saline, I mean, you know, and brackish, you know, river water. And of course, you know, these industries, you know, still are in operation, you know, still now there are Gambian villages. You know, whose main preoccupation, you know, particularly for women, it was, you know, like a gendered, you know, occupation, you know, was to, I mean, process salt, you know, from the river, you know, from the river Gambia, the river Saloum, the river Casamas.
Yes.
So salt was produced in huge quantities. And of course, this salt was also traded along the Sahara. But not only along the Sahara, I mean, even the provision, you know, the slave ships, you know, I mean, when the slave ships came, you know, they had to buy rice on their homeward journey, you know, buy rice, you know, from the African, you know, rulers, and also salt, you know, dry fish, you know, I mean, so as to provision the crew and the slave cargo. I mean, as they journey across the Middle Passage, you see, and really, like a lot of the, you know, gold, you know, from Bambouk, you know, in present day Eastern Senegal, you know, coming, across the River Gambia was traded with salt. such that if you look at the blue books of the Gambia, I mean colony, you see a lot of importation of gold, you know, and much of this gold, you know, did not come from what we call the Gambia today, but from Bambouk. But if the people of Bambouk needed salt, they really had to trade with people living along the river Gambia. Insult, you know, they give them their gold and they give them their salt, you know.
So let's go to the Abrahamic religions and how they spread across the continent. From the very beginning, they have been on the continent. You know, Islam has been in Ethiopia from the very beginning, Christianity as well, and so is Judaism. But the incursion, widespread incursion occurred around the time the Europeans started really coming with missionaries. And also when Islam started to spread across Central and Western Africa with the jihads. So how important was the role of these new religions, and how did it really create a new society and tear apart the old one that existed before the coming of the new religion?
Very important. The new religions introduced literacy, I think, first and foremost. Ability to read and write. That was very, very important. And in Dr. Toby's book, you will see how literacy played a very, very important part in bringing Africa into the international, trade system. Islam, in every court, in every court, you had scribes, who would take down notes, just do like secretarial work for the king. Even the king can be a pagan, like a non-believer in Islam. Yet, and they never, minded having, Muslim scribes, who would, keep records for them, help, collect economic data, trade data, and also even, spread literacy, because whenever you were converted, for example, into Islam, you had to now, try to be literate. In Arabic, you read and then you write. So I think, the Abrahamic religions did very well in spreading literacy. The same for Christianity, like when Christianity, was introduced into what is today called the Gambia, for example, in the early 1800s, the first thing, the Quakers, did, was to establish, a school.
Mission schools.
Battles. Yeah, mission schools. Yes. And really, that helped build up a new African elite, who went into commerce, into trade. And later, their descendants, became the nationalist leaders. I'm talking about the Krio. Or like the Aku in Sierra Leone and the Gambia. Who really became, the elite who began to clamor for independence, you see. So I think on the issue of literacy, Abrahamic religions, were very, very influential in helping to build a new society and really to destroy, what I can call the old society, where everybody, thought about your village or your kingdom and nothing more. Yes.
Okay. And then when we come to the era of colonization, because prior to the era of colonization, say the 1800s to the 1900s, early 1900s, it was inconceivable for European powers to think they could take over many empires across the continent. But one thing changed. It was the era of the machine gun and the era of information. There was now widespread information. How were these African empires colonized quite quickly, to be honest? I mean, within two generations, which is 50 years, much of the continent became part of European states. How did this happen so quickly?
I think the answer is simple. One, superior weaponry, and two, European unity. From Berlin, Europe almost went to war against itself as a scramble for colonies. Yes. Then they called Berlin 1884, 1885. And they among themselves, you know, it was like a mini, you know, EU. You know, all the problems were thrashed out. Africa, you know, was divided among themselves. And they stuck to the agreements made at Berlin.
Yeah.
So, you know, European unity, you know, I mean, was very, very important. You know, they did not, I mean, break the clauses of the Berlin protocols, the French state where they were asked to stay, the British state, you know, where they were asked to stay, the Portuguese state where they were asked to stay, and so on and so forth. So I think that, you know, that unity also helped to entrench, I mean, the colonial, you know, incursion. Now and then, for example, in the Gambia, the French and, you know, British forces will come together, you know, to attack, like a resistant leader, you know, like Foddy Kabarunga. He was defeated, you know, thanks to the help of, you know, French troops, you know, from present-day Senegal. You see, so that and superior, you know, arms, I think, you know, facilitated, the European, you know, intrusion into Africa.
The final question, I mean, as a historian looking at the past, why do you think many of the states today have not charted a new course for their future? That on the international stage, African states, quite frankly, are still at the bottom of the ladder, you know, in terms of decision making and in terms of how things are done. Why do you think so?
Well, I think generally economy. I want to ascribe it to poor economy. As long as we are dependent on the West, you know, the Bretton Woods institutions, you know, bilateral, multilateral, as long as we are dependent on those, you know, to do basic work like road construction, bridges, to build universities, you know, our freedom to maneuver independently will be curtailed. I think we have to fix the African economy for it to be strong.
So now we speak with Dr. Stephen Pierce, who teaches African history at the University of Manchester.
All right. Hey, welcome. So today we'll be discussing the formation of African states and looking at key states in Africa, in pre-colonial Africa.
You see very gradually happening a sort of consolidation of authority, which is at one and the same time political authority and religious authority and an authority over sort of outside workers. Is this all making sense?
Yeah, that's very interesting. The idea of fusing, you know, it's never really far away from each other, you know, religion and politics. They always sort of come together in this awkward dance and make...
You're very right. And I mean, in fact, the notion that politics and religion are different things is in some ways a very recent product of Western Europe. And it's not something that human beings across most of history would have recognized.
Exactly.
And in Bantu traditions, in fact, this varies from place to place. It's not as if the Bantu are all one culture, obviously. But there are two very tight relationships between religion and politics and medicine. And, you know, also, you know, so you might call it family counseling and things like that. But, I mean, in fact, having a relationship with the ancestors is a way of guaranteeing the prosperity of your family, of sort of having harmonious family relations also enables the crops to prosper. It causes the rains to come. And that is something which is the responsibility, not just of the heads of the family, but of the chief himself. But sickness, is likely to be a consequence of the ancestors being unhappy or of strife, between neighbors. So if your child is sick, it may be because I'm jealous of you and am causing your family harm. And so, you know, that's an issue of religion. It's a question of family relationships. It's also a question of politics.
Exactly.
And, you know, human beings don't draw hard and fast distinctions between that. And the notion that somehow it's an advanced way of being in the world is, first of all, profoundly silly, but it is a product of a particular set of European political projects which have to do with the history of European states. So, and Congo did it in a different way, which doesn't make it better or worse, just different.
Exactly. I think that was well put, actually, in terms of just outlining the basis for political authority in the Congo. Let's talk a bit about things that are more dear to your work, which is the Kano, the state of Kano, and the impact of Islam there in infusing political authority and religious authority.
Well, so Kano is, you know, a wonderful sort of example of, you know, another kind of political tradition. Of course, Kano long predates Islam. So the first archaeological sites we find in this modern location of Kano date from the latter part of the 7th century of the Common Era. So, you know, we're talking about a city which has, in one form or another, been around for, you know, 1,300 years.
Mm-hmm.
So Kano is particularly old for the states in these Hausa-speaking regions. But the first and important sort of fact to know about that region is that for much of their history, they were growing up in a kind of no man's land between major empires. So to the east, of course, they had the major sort of power of Kanem-Borno. And then further to the west, the sort of hegemonic empires shifted. So the earliest noteworthy one, of course, is the ancient empire of Ghana, which emerged at the end of the first millennium of the Common Era. But Ghana and then Mali and then Songhai, as well as a number of other noteworthy states. And so the Hausa states were sort of caught between these major powers. But what is noteworthy about those major powers is that they were growing up around very long distance trade routes across the Sahara Desert to North Africa and the Middle East. And so there were Arabs and Muslim traders coming into the savanna regions of West Africa very early on, and so from 1,000 years ago. And so the Hausa states, like Kano, were not a center of that trade. At that time, they were sort of very small provincial places, but they did begin to emerge as a center of metalworking and textile manufacture. They were producing agricultural goods. They were a source of slaves, almost certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And places like Kano, beginning about 1,000 years ago, were creating centralized governments which had kings and which were modeling themselves on the political forms of the major cosmopolitan empire of the region, which was Borno. And so a number of the words that we see in Hausa for political forms are actually borrowed from the Kanuri language.
Mm.
And many of the sort of trappings of the monarchy, and this is true even until today, are borrowed from those Borno forms. So very gradually, over a process of centuries, there are Muslims coming into the region, and the Hausa states are drawn into this very long distance trade. And of course, some people in Kano are converting to Islam. Now, you know, one of the sort of difficult tasks of the historian is to trace out sort of these very complicated issues of faith. Because on the one hand, there are instrumental reasons why some people become Muslims. That is, it is lucrative to be able to trade with sort of cosmopolitan centers where the people are Muslim. And it facilitates those trading relationships if you also are a Muslim. On the other hand, we also have to keep in mind what an extraordinarily compelling faith and powerful way of understanding the world and understanding the divine Islam presents. So I don't either want to denigrate questions of faith or sort of questions of the sort of pragmatic use of being Muslim. So all of these are happening at the same time. At any rate, clearly, so we see Muslims in the regions of Kano and the other Hausa states, you know, early on in the last millennium. The king of Kano himself becomes Muslim in the 15th century of the Common Era. So the sort of great first Muslim king is called Muhammad Rumfa. And so he is famous for many things, including building the Emir's Palace of Kano, which, you know, continues to be called Gidan Rumfa. So yeah, it's Rumfa's house.
Interesting. I mean, but eventually Kano would be supplanted by the Sokoto Caliphate and become a member of the Emirates.
Yes. Well, so the king of Kano and other Hausa monarchs become they become Muslim, you know, sort of roughly 500 years ago. It varies exactly when, and they remain Muslim more or less. I mean, it depends on the monarch and his own spiritual inclinations. So the great Berber cleric, Al-Maghili, comes into Hausa land and actually does sort of influence the practice of Islam and, sort of legal scholarship, and sort of leaves a sort of great imprint in the region. But there's also still a great deal of non-Muslim religiosity there. And so, the spirit possession practice, Bori, which almost certainly is strongly connected to pre-Islamic religious practice. It's not just a sort of technology for dealing with spirit possession. That remains very powerful. And there are sort of local heads of Bori who are, appointed by the king. This continues sort of, into the Sokoto Caliphate and into the present. It is not that Islam and other form, that Islam completely supplants other forms of religiosity. But what changes, of course, is that in the latter part of the 18th century of the Common Era, a sort of set of major reform movements crisscrosses the entire Islamic world. And in Arabia, of course, one of the sort of primary centers is, of course, the Wahhabi movement.
That brings in the House of Saud.
Ultimately, yes, that's what it will do. But, the Wahhabis, of course, are very much anti-Sufi.
Yes.
When you get down to West Africa, the configurations are very different. And one of the major centers of reform, is a network of ethnic Fulani. So the Fulani, of course, are cattle herding nomadic people who seem to have originated in Senegambia. But they were expanding with their cattle across much of West Africa. And, considerable numbers of Fulani, across centuries settled down in cities, converted to Islam, and, many of them became very noteworthy, Islamic scholars. So, if we sort of flash forward to the latter part of the 18th century, one particularly noteworthy young, Fulani cleric lives in the house estate of Gobir. His name is Usman Danforio. He is sort of very much attuned to the reformist debates that are such a central concern across the entire world. Now, Usman Danforio is not a Wahhabi. He's a Sufi. He's a member of the Qadiri order. And again, I'm maybe going into too much detail here, but in essence, what happens is that he preaches against much of the sort of improper practice of religion, the sort of syncretism which is being tolerated in Gobir and sort of elsewhere in these sort of Hausa speaking states. He condemns the king of Gobir for all of this sort of nonsense that he's tolerating. So he sees an opportunity when the king dies and another young royal becomes the new king of Gobir, and this is someone he has actually taught. And so he hopes for a while that this new king is going to implement a number of his reformist ideas. Doesn't happen. relations between them quickly sour.
Mm-hmm.
And Usman Danforio and his followers withdraw from the capital of Gobir, which is always an ominous sign when you have a sort of community sort of proclaim that they are unable to practice religion the way they ought to, and they go to another place. So they withdrew, and they engaged in a process of preparation, of making alliances, among other groups, with the nomadic Fulani, who for the most part were not Muslim, or not sort of really devoutly Muslim. They were pretty syncretistic. But they didn't like paying tax to the kings of the house estates, and they were very impressed by the fact that Usman Danforio declared that the cattle tax they were supposed to pay was not canonical and therefore was forbidden. So Usman Danforio makes a set of alliances with Fulani in many regions in what's now northern Nigeria. He makes alliances with rural Fulani. He makes alliances with other people who are disaffected with the House Estates, and they launch a holy war which conquers Gobir and a number of the other House Estates. Now, the emirs of some of those states, the House of Kings of some of those states actually managed to flee and to reestablish their kingdom somewhere else. So the House of King of Katsina sort of reestablishes a state in Maradi, now a city in Niger Republic. The House of King of Zazao reestablishes a state, Abuja. The King of Daura actually reestablishes a state. The Kings of Kano never manage it. But But at any rate, what emerges at the end is a whole sort of constellation of sort of Fulani-ruled states, which had previously been small sort of independent kingdoms. And the rulers of those states acknowledge Usman Danforio as their ultimate overlord. And, you know, sort of thus comes into being this sort of extraordinary state of the Sokoto Caliphate.
Exactly. I mean, and Usman Danforio was really an intellectual. It was his right-hand man who did much of the fighting. And much of his rule was just focused on keeping the states together, because there were always threats of secession all the time, because he himself reimposed the taxes that he felt were that he campaigned to use to get into office. So,
Exactly. That is, many of Usman Danforio's reformist ideas were not sustainable if what you had to do was keep an actual functioning state together.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, you know, I suppose, luckily for him, that early generation of leaders was just extraordinarily talented. So it's not just Usman Danforio, but his brother, Abdullahi.
Exactly.
His son, Mohamed Bello, his daughter, Nana Asma'u. There were a whole set of brilliant theologians and jurists right there in the family who could sort of theorize an empire which was on the one hand theologically sustainable, but on the other hand would actually work.
Exactly. And eventually it was defeated in 1903 by the British. And
Yes. So, I mean, ultimately it was conquered, but on the other hand, it would have been very difficult for any state to manage to remain independent of Great Britain.
Yeah, around that, exactly. Because of technological advances and, you know, better knowledge by the British of the entire region in terms of what they had to do.
It is very difficult to stand up against machine guns if you've got flintlocks.
Exactly. I mean, and this is all over the region. I mean, even in the Battle of Omdurman. I mean, that's like the best example of 50 men or so defeating thousands because of the machine gun.
Exactly. I mean, it is very noteworthy that really the instance you see of an African state which managed to remain independent is, you know, Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And what you see there is, first of all, the European power that's trying to conquer Ethiopia is Italy, which doesn't have the resources and the might of Britain. But then they also had Emperor Menelik, who was a brilliant tactician, not just in military terms, but also in diplomatic terms. And so he was able to sort of keep the Italians at bay long enough so that he was able to build up modern military technology to such a standard he was able to hold them off. You know, Asante maybe came relatively close to holding the British off, but, you know, they couldn't do it. And, it, you know, if the Asante couldn't, who would have been able to?
I mean, Asante literally means because of war. They were they were warring people. That's why they controlled all of what is present day Ghana.
Yes.
this leads us to the next point, actually. And also the Ethiopians as well had the benefit of hindsight, having chased away the Jesuits in the 15th century.
Yes.
So they knew what it was to chase away the Europeans, and they also had the Russians as allies because of the Orthodox Church as well. So they had that European support. Anyways, let's move on to East Africa, which we have just done, in terms of like the states that were there around this point in time. I mean, one of them could be Buganda that we could talk about. Mm-hmm. What exactly, which is the successor state for Uganda today? And of course the Swahili states on the coast that, you know, controlled trade for thousands of years and in the 15th century were very wealthy, like Kilwa, for example.
And, yes.
So what kind of states were there around in pre-colonial times, and what was the basis for their existence?
Well, you know, I think that in this region as well, you probably need to link the basis of a lot of at least larger scale state formation to the emergence of long distance trading networks. That is, you can think of sort of states and trade as being a kind of mutually reinforcing cycle. In some sense, a state, you know, ends up being a little bit more than a protection racket. Oh, well, that means an awfully nice farm you had. It would be a real shame if something happens to it. Luckily, I've got, you know, my warriors with me, and we'll protect you if you just pay us some taxes. The difficulty, of course, of long distance trade is that when you are a merchant taking goods that it is sort of worth investing in and sort of taking far from home, you are acutely vulnerable as you're doing that transportation. So, in order to get that trade going, you need to have political authorities who are sufficiently powerful to guarantee the safety of merchants. But it's hard to finance a state able to do that. So in essence, you need the taxes of the merchants in order to support a state who can enable the trade in the first place. So what you see happening almost always is that trade routes and states grow up in tandem with each other. And that is very much the case both on the coast and in the interior. So the states in the Great Lakes region are... In some ways, you can draw some parallels with what we were talking about in West Central Africa. I mean, that is to say, there are exceptions to this rule, say around Rwanda, which has been quite densely populated for a long time.
Yeah, Rwanda.
Rwanda,
Urundi area.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But you know, for the most part, you know, population densities still were not high. And so you certainly do see chieftaincies that emerge, and they're emerging about security. They're emerging in relation to ideas about metaphysics. I mean, so chiefs in large part are emerging because of their ability to guarantee health and prosperity and security. They're also emerging across, in relation to, you know, trade routes. Now, the Great Lakes kingdoms are, interesting in that there seems to have been a sort of real sort of explosion in their sort of scope and sort of imperial ambition, precisely as the states of the Swahili coast were capitalizing caravans into the interior to be exporting sort of ivory and sort of, this is quite a bit to the south of, Buganda now, but gold, of course, is a very significant export. About 1,000 years ago, you see, a state like Great Zimbabwe emerging in relation to the gold mines. And then sort of later on, a rather similar kind of empire emerging in, Mwene Mutapa.
Exactly.
Buganda is interesting. So, of course, it emerges first of all as a relatively small tributary state to Bunyoro, which is another Great Lakes kingdom. Buganda becomes sort of supercharged in the 18th century and into the 19th century. And that is exactly when the caravans into the interior are also becoming sort of denser and more ambitious, and also, to be perfectly honest, more predatory. As you get into the middle part of the 19th century, the Sultan of Zanzibar is capitalizing an absolutely devastating traffic in slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, Buganda is not a major slaving power, there's sort of trade routes that are so dynamic in large part because of the slave trade are also very much a part of what has brought Buganda into being.
Exactly. And that story is not often told, the Indian Ocean slave trade. I mean, it was extensive, not as extensive as the transatlantic slave trade. But indeed, you know, one person leaving the shores is a loss. So it was, it was quite an extensive trade. And it persisted for centuries. I mean, you had like middlemen that probably like Tipu Tip from the interior, who was an African slave trader and very notorious for shipping a lot of people outside the continent. But please continue.
What you see happening is that Buganda increasingly powerful and expansionist, in part because of a basic political logic from within the region itself, so that outlying areas are more sort of firmly under the control of the monarch, whose title is the Kabaka, they are more firmly under his control and produce more sort of revenue for his pockets than more inland areas closer to the center, which are ruled by the aristocracy. They have a sort of powerful middleman kind of role there. Mm-hmm. So it's in the Kabaka's interest to expand his kingdom. So in essence, as the Kabaka becomes more powerful in Buganda, Buganda itself becomes more expansionist.
Interesting. That's really interesting. And yes. And of course, you had the incursion of the Europeans from around the 15th, 16th century as well. The Portuguese fomenting trouble was around that region at that time. But then the Eastern, and you mentioned Mutapa, is very connected to the Southern region.
Yes.
And because the Southern region has a very peculiar history in that Europeans have been settled there since the 15th century as a VOC trading post, the history of the Africans in that region sort of been marginalized in favor of the history of the white Europeans in that region. So, can we talk a bit about the states that were there before the Mfecane? Because that's the most popular thing, you know, the crushing by Shaka Zulu. But before that, you had a series of kingdoms and states that were around there that had a basis on cattle, on homesteads, and also quite violent as well, but majorly not as strong as Europeans that came with firearms. So what states were there around this period, like Great Zimbabwe, and which other states as well?
There's a whole range of states. Now, so in on the Zimbabwean plateau, of course, you've got these two great Shona-speaking empires of Great Zimbabwe and then Mwene Mutapa. In many ways, we don't know too terribly much about Great Zimbabwe because we have oral traditions and we have archaeology. So we know that the rulers of Great Zimbabwe were trading with the Indian Ocean Sea, because we have Chinese pottery,
exactly,
in Zimbabwe. Now, one of the reasons we know a great deal more about Mweni Mutapa is that we've got the accounts of Portuguese travelers to Mweni Mutapa, which tells us very interesting sort of things about the political makeup of the kingdoms. So, for example, the Portuguese tell us that the king was assisted in ruling Mweni Mutapa with, I believe it was 9 wives. Now, not all of these wives were women, and not all of the wives were real wives.
Really?
So, now I'm telling you this off the top of my head, so I may be getting some of these details wrong. This is not, my own area of study. But the first wife was, in fact, the king's sister, typically, or a close female relative. And then, sort of the number two wife was male. This was not some sort of, marital or, sort of homosexual relationship. This was a more an official position. I mean, of course,
very could have
to tell what was going on in the private life of a king centuries ago. The number three wife was in fact a wife. That is a woman who was actually married to the king. But all of these wives had, particular areas of responsibility. So I forget which wife it was, but one of them was responsible for diplomatic relationships with Muslims. And it was quite one of the most senior. I think it was number one or number two, which indicates just how important trade with the caravan trade must have been.
Exactly, because the Muslims controlled the trade on the coast.
Exactly. And, so large numbers of them would have been in the caravans going through the kingdom. One of the other wives is responsible for diplomatic relationships with the Europeans. In addition to this, wives sat in judicial capacity. So, if I were having a dispute with my wife, that is my own wife, mm-hmm. I might need to go to get the case judged. If I were particularly important, maybe I would have ended up having it judged by a wife.
Interesting.
They also had vassals. They collected taxes. They had a whole set of responsibilities. And so, and we have these travel accounts where the Portuguese, report this. And of course, they're, fairly horrified that, you have men who are being called wives and, you have women who've got this kind of authority. And, this all shows just how depraved these people were.
Big superiority complex. And of course, they've been there as well, establishing bases in current day Luanda. So they also had their own area of control in trading for slaves with the Congolese kingdom as well.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You get these very interesting kinds of trajectories in these Portuguese areas because, as you say, there's an entire kingdom of Angola that gets created as a Portuguese colony. Now, sort of direct areas of Portuguese rule are relatively limited in Angola until the 19th century, but it exists. And of course, it's causing a great deal of sort of trouble and chaos in those kingdoms. In the areas of Mozambique, you see another kind of pattern emerging because as sort of relations with Mweni Mutapa sour and sort of in this period in which Portugal is very much dominating the Indian Ocean trade, closer to the coast of Mozambique, what you see happening is that the Crown of Portugal actually grants basically fiefdoms to sort of conquering warriors, but the terms of the grant make those fiefdoms heritable through the female line. And so you get these very and the term for one of these fiefs is a prazo. And the rulers of the fiefs are called prazeros. And they are basically a hereditary nobility, sort of being passed down through the female line, although it's an entirely male dominated. The sort of holders, the prazeros identify as being Portuguese, and they are sort of rulers of a Portuguese colony. But as time passes, they become less and less and less culturally Portuguese. And of course, they're marrying, local women. So, sort of physically speaking, they look more and more absolutely African. And in many sort of cultural ways, they are behaving more and more like African chiefs. So there's this sort of adaptation of European forms of rule. And I am in no way, shape, or form trying to suggest that this is not colonial or that it is not racist or it is not intrinsically exploitative. Quite the opposite. But it is a kind of colonialism which looks very different from the sorts of sort of modernist, scientifically racist, colonialism and exploitation you see coming to the fore in the 19th century.
Exactly. And I guess that sort of like at least gives the listener sort of an introduction into the southern half of Africa. Even today, there's like a disconnect between the northern half and the sub-Saharan part of Africa. But that's actually not been true. The whole of the continent has been connected from antiquity. There's been a lot of trade with caravans, gold passing up through with camels up then, up into Europe, cloth as well from Kano down to Morocco. So, but also there's been conflict. And the most notable is the defeat of the Songhai by the Moroccan. that was sort of like a decimation, really. And even before the Moroccans, you had the Almoravids and Almohads that, you know, brought a lot of culture and a lot of wonderful things to that region. But in terms of the northern part of Africa, what exactly was going on around the 15th, 16th century in that region that you know of, like in terms of how they, of course, Islam had spread, Judaism as well. Even Christianity had been there since, I mean, St. Augustine is from North Africa.
Yes.
So what kind of states were they seeking to do, especially when they defeated the Songhai?
Yes, well, Morocco is a very interesting case, of course, because, you know, sort of after the Almoravid state fell apart, you know, not that long after its great adventures in Ghana, so the Almoravids don't last too terribly long. Morocco does sort of descend into a certain amount of sort of chaos and instability for several centuries, which becomes particularly acute because it is under pressure, on the one hand, from the Ottoman Empire, which, of course, is the dominant political power across most of North Africa for much of the period we're talking about.
Yeah, that's true. Isn't that the period of Suleiman the Magnificent, isn't it?
So from that point, but it lasts for some centuries. I mean, by sort of the 18th century, I mean, to the extent the Ottomans are sort of acknowledged as sovereign, I mean, nonetheless, sort of local rulers have a great deal of autonomy, to say the least. But there is at least sort of nominal Ottoman
control,
Ottoman authority. Yes, but in addition to the Ottomans, of course, you know, so beginning, so as you get to the 15th century, but you know, 14th, 15th century, the Iberians are an increasing presence around the coastline of Africa, and they are putting the Moroccans under a great deal of pressure. So part of what is happening with the Moroccan incursion into Songhai is that the Sultan of Morocco is under a great deal of pressure. He needs to have a source of wealth so that he can hold off the Ottomans and the Portuguese and the Spanish. And Songhai, of course, is a major source of gold.
Exactly.
So the idea is if you can just get control of Songhai, you're going to be, make yourself so powerful that these other sort of very dangerous powers will hold off. The problem, of course, is that Songhai is so far away from Morocco that it gets completely overextended. And, you know, this sort of great plan to make Morocco into a major power, you know, really does not come off.
Exactly. Exactly. Especially because there were so many threats, internal threats to authority. Because, you know, with each generation, you have someone who's even more Muslim than the last person, and then they remove you because of that. And it's just like an endless cycle.
Yes.
It wasn't until they got the, in Morocco, I think the person who they believe is a descendant of the Prophet, that that line has now sort of stabilized that monarchy to today, actually.
Yes. Well, and of course, one thing I, in sort of my career, sort of making bold pronouncements about the stability of regimes, I have learned to stop saying anything about, you know, what I think could never possibly happen, because whenever I have, I've turned out to be wrong.
Everything changes. That's the nature of humanity. Everything is always changing.
Well, yes, no condition is permanent.
Exactly.